Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles, and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 14th of January 1923, France occupies the Ruhr, the Fitzroy case finally comes to an end, I hope, and Henry Ford throws his hat into the ring. Not in this episode for reasons of time, ignorance or sloth. Lenin was unwell, there was a lively debate on capital punishment, and the Great Western Railway hosted a classical concert. Now, the observant of you may have noticed that there's a missing week. There is no, as yet, no episode for the 7th of January 1923. Well, there's a reason for this. My theory is that at the moment, with the recording coming out at the end of the week, it means that if there's a centenary which takes place in the middle of the week beforehand, and people are interested in finding out more, well, they can't look to me because I haven't actually published the recording yet. So if I get ahead of time, you know, ahead by a week, then the recording will be there should they be interested. And if that sounds like cynical marketing, well, you could argue that. I would argue it means that more people will hear my pearls of wisdom, if you can indeed hear a pearl. Anyway, that's theory. I have done some research into the 7th of January episode. It may yet happen, but as always, I promise nothing. Anyway, on to the show. The big story this week is that the French have occupied the Ruhr. Now, I cover the background to this reasonably well, I think, in the reparations special. But the sort of proximate cause of this is that the Germans have failed to deliver some timber. This is obviously the payment, an example of the payment in kind that they were supposed to be making. And, the Reparations Commission has said that the Germans are in default, and the French have said, right, okay, well, we shall occupy the Ruhr, in case you're unaware of this. The Ruhr is a collection of cities in the Ruhr Valley. It's on the right bank of the Rhine, cities like Essen, Dortmund, a few others, and it is the centre of industry in Germany. This is from Friday the 12th of January. Essen was occupied this afternoon by two divisions of French troops. Many houses and shops had drawn their blinds, but until the railway station itself was reached, there was nothing unusual to be seen. Here, large numbers of men were gathered in the square. The main body of the French forces came down the hill leading from Bredene to the railway station and chief post office. At the head rode a party of cyclists in dark blue uniform and steel helmets, closely followed by five party-coloured armoured cars. I'm not quite sure what party-coloured means. I think camouflaged. It goes on. From these grim-looking cars, of which the occupants were invisible, stood out the muzzles of machine guns, a silent threat to the sullen crowd. So how's this going down in Germany? On Sunday, the flags of official buildings are to be flown at half-mast. Special exhortations are awaited from the pulpits, and all places of public entertainment are to be closed. The Times inevitably has an editorial. This is also from Friday the 12th of January. Once more, a decisive moment has come in the troubled history of modern Europe. New ways are being tested to solve the bewildering problems of the peace, and whither these ways may lead, none can tell. The French government have chosen to act on methods of their own devising in order to compel Germany to pay the reparations due from her. These methods have the reluctant support of Belgium and the uncertain acquiescence of Italy. They are, however, strongly disapproved by the British government and by the main body of British opinion. In the United States, as our Washington correspondent pointed out yesterday morning, the course taken by France has aroused anger and repulsion. Neutral opinion is alarmed. The Times here does not exactly as such explain why what the British objection is. I can't find an explanation this week. In the previous week, and I have done some research into this, so well, you'll have to wait for that episode. But the expression that the British use is that Germany's credit must be restored. That, and until that happens, there is just no prospect of getting anything out of the Germans. The question I find myself in is, what do they mean by credit? Do they mean the ability for Germany to borrow money, which doesn't strike me as being really here nor there, unless it's essential to foreign trade. I don't know. I don't know the ins and outs of that. I think what it means is that Germany must sort out its inflation and its public finances problem, which may be the case, although I must doubt it. I have this awful suspicion that to both the British and the French are wrong. Anyway, it goes on. With a brave display, French cavalry and infantry marched yesterday into Essen before the eyes of a sullen and resentful German population. There was an intimidating show of strength that may arouse in France a momentary feeling of pride, yet in the watching world the spectacle cannot but produce grave anxiety for the possible consequences to France herself, and anxiety for all the work of peace now placed in jeopardy. For, to all intents and purposes, France in this decisive moment is alone. Alone she is venturing eastward into the mazes of a continent still darkened by the lingering shadows of war. Except for a small force of Belgians, her companions in guarding the Rhine are not with her in this advance into the unknown. The Americans have signified their emphatic disapproval of the step by giving orders for the withdrawal of their troops from Koblenz. I must confess, I did not know this, and it strikes me as something that's much more important than people tend to think. It goes on. The British troops remain for the present at Cologne, as a pledge of our hope that in spite of our complete disagreement with the French in their present methods, the day may yet come when it will be possible for the Allies to once more to collaborate closely in the execution of the Treaty of Peace. Nothing can disguise the impression of the essential loneliness of France in this momentous enterprise. It goes on. It is inevitable, however, as our Paris correspondent points out, that some doubt and anxiety should be felt in France, and indeed the problems to be faced are formidable. The French programme, as indicated in the note, communicated to the Allied governments and to Germany, has already been complicated by the rapid march of events. The idea of using the existing German industrial organisation in the Ruhr as a means of diverting to French use a percentage of the coal production has been partly frustrated by the removal to Hamburg of the personnel and the archives of the coal syndicate, which was the crown of the intricate organisation of the Ruhr industry, and through which the German government levied the coal tax. It goes on. It is not easy to dig coal with bayonets. The danger of the French attempt to solve an economic problem by military means lies in the constant occasions such an attempt provides to supplant the normal and profitable working of industry by coercion, to the destruction of all hope of profit. Such a very British point of view. It goes on. Is the course the French are now pursuing calculated to yield the sum needed to cover the deficit in the French budget? If French troops are drawn through the force of events deeper and deeper into Germany, if thereby the whole intricate machinery of German industry, with its vitally interdependent areas, is dislocated and paralysed, will France gain much more than the bare upkeep of her army? This was something that came up, so far, a few weeks ago. Britain has not received any more than her costs of maintaining her army. It goes on. There is nothing in the British attitude to encourage Germany in going to reckless extremes in her opposition to French coercion. That's just nonsense. The fact that Britain and France are divided on this absolutely encourages the Germans, because they think they might be able to win and divide the Allies. Anyway, one saga that has been going on for almost as long as reparation is the Sir Almeric Fitzroy affair, which I first covered on the 15th of October 1922 episode. Anyway, his having been found not guilty himself, his chief accuser is now in court facing a perjury charge. This is from Saturday the 13th of January. The jury found the defendant guilty and strongly recommended her to mercy. Mr. Justice Darling said his view was that Broadbridge found herself in the position that if she had not said she was annoyed, she might have been charged with soliciting. She was an unfortunate person who had suffered a good deal, and she had not committed the crime for gain or to injure anyone. He bound the defendant over in her own recognizances in £20 to come up for judgment if called on. There's a lot of legal speak in that last sentence. I think what it means is that she has to pay £20 into court, and that should she commit a similar offence in the next 12 months or so, then she'll lose the £20 and that offence will be taken into consideration. Well, that would appear to be the end of the case. I ought to be able to come up with some sort of summary for it, but I've been racking my brains as to what I would say. I mean, the party seemed to be innocent. Fitzroy, his accuser, the police, and they all seem to have done, to be innocent enough. Nothing wicked or evil about their actions. The law has acted correctly, although it does demonstrate, as I've said before, the importance of having a good lawyer. And the result is fair enough, I'd have to say. I think the only thing you can say is that it's a pretty stupid law. One person you wouldn't describe as being stupid is Henry Ford, but you might describe him as being a bit crazy. This is from Tuesday the 9th. Through the same organisation that built up the enormous business in Ford Motor Cars, Mr. Henry Ford's supporters have launched his boom for the presidency. 7,000 sales agents for Ford cars throughout the United States have already received dollar membership cards for the Dearborn Ford for President Club, and the slogan "We Want Henry" is to be echoed all over the land. Through his weekly organ, the Dearborn Independent, Mr. Ford's attacks on the Jews have been incessant. Every political and financial ill of the world he lays at their doors. It goes on. Mr. Ford's chances of obtaining nomination are practically nil. One of the world's richest men promoting opinions that posterity will see as nutty and dangerous. Couldn't happen today. But anti-Semitism was trendy in those days, just like communism. This is from Friday the 12th of January, and it's an article actually about fascism, but communism gets a walk-on part. It is remarkable that nearly all the socialists who have gone over to fascismo are ex-communists. It goes on. The death blow to Russian influence in Italy was the report of the Italian socialist mission to Moscow. That report was very similar to the account brought back to England by Mr. H.G. Wells and Mrs. Philip Snowden, and produced much the same effect on the socialist leaders as Mrs. Snowden's report has apparently had on Mr. Snowden. By a singular anachaluthon, they keep their devotion to state control while condemning a system which state control is supreme. Wells and Mrs. Snowden had visited the Soviet Union recently and had come back saying, well, it wasn't very good. When it comes to anachaluthon, the best I can do is it's a sort of contradiction in terms, or a contradiction, or apparent contradiction. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.